Okay, government operations and elections will come to order. We do have a quorum. Do we have minutes? Representative O'Driscoll, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes from the meeting, our 16th meeting, which was on the 24th of February 2011.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the minutes of February 24th. Any corrections or additions?
What's that?
Do you have your minutes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Minutes are approved. And we will take up House File 613. You're not on the committee, so it needs to move to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, I will move House File 613 for Representative Kelly and to be referred to the General Register upon vote.
Okay, Representative O'Driscoll moves that House File 613 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Two-year bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity here. This is really a procedural issue down in Red Wing. The Red Wing Port Authority has asked that we actually reduce the number of years for their terms of their appointed board members. Unfortunately, I believe the situation arisen because it's kind of difficult to get people to commit to a six-year term versus a three-year term. And that is all the bill does, reducing the term.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Kelly. I guess the question I have is, currently there are six-year staggered terms. Are you going to stagger the terms, or is everyone's term going to end at the same time? How are they contemplating dealing with that?
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, the intent would be to continue staggering the terms. I don't know exactly where everyone's at right now, Representative Nelson, but the intent would be to have that continuity of leadership as well.
Any other questions for Representative Kelly? Okay, hearing no further questions, all those in favor of the bill, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. House File 613 will be placed on the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think we're going to have to recess for don't go anywhere, but we're going to have to recess for just a minute. I just got word that Representative Erickson is in a conference committee, was not planning on being here for a half hour. We're going to try to find Representative Runbeck, so we will recess for just maybe 2-3 minutes.
Thank you.
Committee will come back to order, and we will, since Representative Erickson got here first, we will take up House File 511. Representative Erickson, does this bill need to go to Education Finance next, or where does this need to go?
This needs to go to Education Finance, yes.
Okay. Representative Sanders, would you like to make a motion for Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 511 be passed and referred to Education Finance.
Okay. Representative Sanders moves House File 511 be recommended to pass and be referred to Education Finance.
And there is an A5 amendment.
A5
if Representative
amendment.
Sanders would move that.
Okay. Yes, Madam Chair, we'll move the A5 amendment.
Representative Sanders moves the A5 amendment. To your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is some clarification on language that has been confusing in statute in regard to the commissioner having the authority to make rules and to continue with that rulemaking process, and in this instance to add the fact that when making rules or creating the rules for the academic standards and the graduation requirements, that the revisions and the realigned academic standards and graduation requirements return to the legislature for the authority to enact them.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions for Representative Erickson on the A5 amendment? Does anyone in the audience need to testify to the A5 amendment? Okay, hearing no discussion, all those in favor of the A5 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. A5 amendment does pass to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just walk you then through the sections of the first engrossment. First of all is a provision in Section 1, Subdivision 5, to allow school boards to conduct meetings using interactive television technology if they comply to the other requirements under this section of law, 13D.02. Section 2 is that which we just amended. Section 3 is changing a provision that I believe was enacted last year in the pension bill to allow school boards to determine the identity and number of vendors for 403B plans. And I think, Madam Chair, I probably should stick to only those which you need to deal with. Then we'd move to Section 5, rulemaking. This is a change that has emphasis on technical changes and corrections can be made when the commissioner is in the midst of rulemaking for children with for rules related to the laws we pass in regard to children with disabilities. That sometimes has been confusing, and we want to ensure that those technical changes, they're not substantive changes, they're just technical in nature, could be made. And finally, Section 9, repealing the January 15th collective bargaining agreement deadline and aid penalty. And with that, Madam Chair, those are the sections that are applicable to government operations.
Thank you. And Mr. Shepard, could you just clarify again so I know, so all the members know which sections we are addressing for government operations?
Madam Chair and members, the sections, as Representative Erickson referenced, are Section 1 with the open meeting laws, Section 2 with rulemaking, Section 3 with the annuity contract, Section 5, rulemaking again, and Section 9 with the deadline.
Okay. Do members have questions at this point? I know there are probably a few people that want to testify, but if anybody has any preliminary questions for Representative Erickson, you can take those now. Okay. I know Ms. Elschweiger would like to testify. There might be others. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Elschweiger, Education, Minnesota. And this is, I guess they call it in some ways, the omnibus mandate bill, because mandate repeal bill. So there are some significant issues, three that I believe I can address today that could in some ways have a hearing all by themselves. But I'll try to keep my comments brief. On section 2, we are concerned on lines 1.22, although I understand there's an amendment, but this is related to the legislative authority. Right now, the commissioner and the commissioner has some authority to do the rulemaking for the graduation, the standards, graduation requirements, benchmarks, etc. I believe what this language does is make it political, because now the curriculum, the standards, those types of issues would now be debated in the legislature. After the department decides what they want to do, it would be reviewed by the legislature. It would go back to the department, I would believe, and then they'd have to submit to the legislature recommended changes in the relevant academic standards, graduation requirements, and related benchmarks. And I don't know if the legislators, I guess I should say, I don't think that the legislators are education experts that would be making, would want to make those decisions, and it becomes more of a political football. And I think as the governing body that you are, I believe that you want to give the authority to the individuals who are the experts and certainly keep on top of what they're doing, absolutely. But we believe that this maybe goes too far. Then I will turn to page 3, line 3.12. There's some history here that I would like to share with you. It was law a number of years ago that an employee of a local unit of government, so I'm speaking of the school districts now, could choose any vendor that they wanted for a 403B. A 403B would be similar to a 401K in the private sector. But in a 403B, as you know, an individual contributes their own money to the 403B, and the employer negotiates and determines how much money they're going to contribute into the 403B. But it is 100% the employee's money. When the person retires, they can take the money. And going back to the historical piece, it was a number of years ago, the law that an individual could seek any vendor that they wanted. And there were a lot of vendors out there. And then a few years ago, a school district unilaterally made the decision to narrow the vendors to only one vendor. Well, that upset the employees, as you can imagine, quite a bit, because they had a history with some of these vendors. And they were then told that they couldn't use their own vendors. They had to use a vendor that was chosen by the school district. There was a lawsuit, and Education Minnesota OSSEO teachers filed a lawsuit, and they actually lost. And they lost because of what the law said. The law was changed then to be the current law, which requires, and if you look at page 3.25. Right now, the current law says that the identity and number of the available vendors under the IRS code is a term and condition of employment. So what that means is that when this law was passed and in current law, it means that the school employees and the school board now have to negotiate and talk about the number and who the vendors are. We're not saying how many there have to be. We're not saying which ones they have to be. But these are our members and they've got their money, 100% of their money with these vendors, we think that they should have a say in the number and the vendors. This has gone very well, and it's worked that we don't think that it's a problem anywhere. We also believe that, I want to pull up some of my notes here, currently this law requires a shared fiduciary responsibility. Because it's bargained, the school district and the employees have a shared responsibility. If you change this language, the language is proposed, the employees no longer have fiduciary responsibility. It now is the responsibility of the school board, and we don't think that that makes a lot of sense either. Over the last couple of years, Minnesota school districts have hired consulting firms and spent considerable time and effort on the selection of investment providers. And the cost for these services range from $10,000 to $20,000 per district, depending on the size of the district. We actually think that this increases school districts' costs because it'll have to go out for RFPs. So we would oppose this section and hope that you would see that it makes sense as well, that if this is 100% of our members' money and it is negotiated and it's working well, and actually it might be costly to go the other direction, that this section would be removed. And then, of course, we are opposed to Section 7, but is it correct, Madam Chair, that I have not to speak to the staff development set aside?
That's correct. That correct. Just 1, 2, 3, 5, and 9.
Okay. And then the last issue that I will touch on is the issue related to the January 15th contract settlement deadline. You have received a handout that shows how well the settlement deadline is working. I would like to first describe it for you, because you're not on the Education Committee, I'm going to just give you a little bit of background. Current law requires that in the two-year period of teacher-only contract negotiations, that there is a January 15th contract settlement deadline in the even-numbered years. And so negotiations now will begin as of March 1st. Officially, negotiations can begin. And then if a contract is not settled, if they don't reach tentative agreement by January 15th, there is a penalty of $25 per pupil. Now, what's been interesting, though, is how much labor management collaboration we have seen as a result of the January 15th contract settlement deadline. If you look at the chart, I'll give this one to the chair. There are three bars that are very high. Thank you. And you'll see that when there wasn't a deadline, 63.6% of the districts were not settled in 97-99, and then two other years when they did a two-year suspension, 73.9 and 66.9 were not settled. Now, what's even more interesting is if you look at the third sheet of this handout, and you will see that there have only been three strikes in the last approximately 17 years when the January 15th deadline was in place. And the strikes have all been in years when there was not a January 15th contract settlement deadline. So this clearly shows with facts and figures that the deadline works. Think about your own job as legislators. You have committee deadlines, and you know that that makes you get your work done. You know that on May 23rd, that is the final day, and that, of course, there can be a special session and there isn't any penalty that way. Of course, there could be if it goes for a while, but you know that deadlines work, and you have experience with that. Let me tell you what else it has done, though. The January 15th contract settlement deadline has forced both sides, teachers and the school district, to come to the table with realistic offers to make them get their work done. There isn't as much positioning as there used to be. Yes, you'll find some personalities, both on the side of teachers and of school district management, school board members, that make it a little bit more challenging. But what has happened is that a number of school districts are now starting to settle their contracts quite early. We have seen a few now settling in the summer, a number of them settling in the fall. Now, some people will say that, oh, you can't do this because it gives the teachers the upper hand, that they get more in the salaries and so on. But if you look at the second sheet, these are there are some facts and figures that clearly demonstrate that the settlements do not increase as you get closer to January 15th. In fact, they decrease. Let me explain the graph. Of course, the first column is the month, and then going across, are the settlements for each of those months, the percent of increase. If you look at the second column, that's the first year of the contract. The second column is the second year of the contract. And if you look at the numbers as you go down towards January 15th, those numbers actually decrease. And this is in aggregate, so it is even a bigger decrease than it would be if they were reported separately. So if you have any questions, I would be more than happy to answer your questions, but we would oppose the bill because of these three sections.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to, on the way of disclosure, I have seen this bill in the Education Reform Committee, and I feel compelled to share some information on item number three that I, with this committee, as I did with the Education Reform Committee, and that has to do with the annuity contract and payroll allocation. Another way of looking at that is the 403B contribution. My involvement in the securities industry, my involvement as well with school districts on this, is that many school districts have been very, very lenient or generous with allowing their employees the opportunity to select a private vendor, which the school district would then sign paperwork allowing that individual to be able to have that particular fund of families to make that investment. What oftentimes happens in those is you'll sit down, you'll visit with a sales representative or a registered representative who will derive a commission from those purchases. I can see the administrative costs associated with the school with 14 or 15 or 16 or 17 different funds of families having to do the withholdings and then forward those dollars. One of the things that this bill will do is it will allow the school district the ability to be able to go as one unified entity to a product provider who will have a host of funds in a family that will meet that individual's needs. So you may have some index funds, you may have some growth and income funds, you may have some technology funds, you may have a whole host of different activities where those sales charges, the more that the individual buys, there's what are called breakpoints that they pay less in fees. The tendency sometimes for people to go out when they're not completely an informed investor is to say, oh, here are three different families of funds. I want to buy this fund, and this fund from the three different funds, which means that they're going to be incurring additional sales charges and less of their money is going to go to work for the employee. The second part of that is they may be thinking they're diversifying because they're choosing from different fund families, but they're actually choosing the same fund family or fund within each of the families, which increases their risk to exposure to risk relative to their investment portfolio. So seriously limiting the number that are available is helpful to the point that it may cost the district more because you have to go out for requests for proposals. I have not seen in other negotiations where we've gone out for requests for proposals where we've seen a higher price than we would have had we just gone and made a direct purchase or signed a direct contract with a vendor. So that's just a little bit of benefit from my experience in the securities industry that I wanted to share with the committee today. It's really not any questions, it's just an information piece. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Murray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Allswager, in talking about the January 15th deadline, I understand the deadline, but it seems like it's kind of one-sided. The district has to settle. The district gets the penalty. The district loses money. What's the other side giving up with the January 15th deadline?
Ms. Allswager.
Madam Chair and Representative Murray, that's an excellent question. I'm very glad you asked that question. Because in virtually every case where they're approaching the January 15th contract settlement deadline, The school board will say to the school employees, to the teachers, and they have every right to say this, that if we don't settle by January 15th, we're taking $25 per pupil out of the package. And often the settlements are less after January 15th.
Okay. Any other questions for the witness? Okay, I think we'll take a couple of more people who have... Oh, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Representative Pepin and Ms. Elsweiger. Tell me if there's any studies or indications of when the January 15th deadline is in effect and when it isn't. Well, let's go back. It's been about 20 years, hasn't it, since the January 15th has been put into effect. Has there been a change in per capita teacher earnings from that time until now?
Ms. Elsweiger.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, that's also an excellent question. I'm glad you asked that. You know, I sometimes will say, I don't know what the problem is, because what are we trying to fix here? Because if you look at teacher salaries in Minnesota and what they have done, it actually isn't anything that we would be proud of. The average teacher salary in Minnesota is $2,000 less than the average teacher salary in the country. Our ranking has gone from, in 2005, from 16th in the country to 20th. Now, it says, well, you're above average. Well, it's because some of those who are at the top are paid quite a bit, but we are still $2,000 less in terms of the actual dollar amount, and we've fallen four places in just a matter of 5 years. The teachers' salaries as a percentage of the budget in the school budget, at one point they were 40.3% in 2000. In 2008, they are now 38.8. So our salaries are getting smaller as a percentage of the school budget. They're getting they're falling in rank as compared to teachers in other states. And as you know, in inflation, teacher salaries increases are lower than inflation in the 6 out of the last 7 years. The inflation rate since 2003 is 2.53, and the average teacher increase since 2003 has been 2.29. So I think that there isn't anything, and this kind of addresses Representative Murray's question, there isn't anything here that indicates that teachers have been doing very well over the last few years. This bill is really about focusing on getting the job done. One thing that I did not mention, but as a former teacher, Representative Erdahl, you probably recognize this, is that when, and probably this is one a very important point for you to realize, is that when the settlements come in early, then they don't drag on over 2, 3, 4 years. You stop the continued discussion on negotiations, and you're able to focus more on the education of our kids, which is what we should be doing.
Senator Erdahl.
Thank you, Representative Pepin. And, well, it just confuses me, because it would stand to reason that if this was such a detriment to school boards, that settlement, that teachers would have a great advantage and their salaries would be going up. I guess I'm just confused. Can you anyone help me out as to why that's not happening?
Representative Erickson?
Madam Chair. Oh, Jan?
You can both give your opinion. Ms. Elsweiger, you can go first.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, our teachers did not go into this job to become wealthy. We all know that. They do make decisions, even at the bargaining table, to make good financial decisions as decisions for the districts. We have a number of districts, our teachers have who have agreed to salary freezes, hard freezes or soft freezes, for 1 year or 2 years. We've got about 23 districts that did that last round. They make decisions because they don't want further cuts to their teachers. They don't want increases in class size. But take a look at what's been happening to their health insurance premiums. I mean, the whole picture needs to be discussed. They're not getting wealthy. They're trying to focus on kids, and they're making good decisions, we think.
Representative Erickson, did you want to comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, of course, the dollars available weigh heavily on what we do here in the legislature. So as I look at the 2 years when we had no deadline, there was probably more money available, and so the negotiations proceed to lag a little bit. At least that was my experience when I was in the field. Another is, I don't think that the percentages that Education Minnesota uses include the benefits. And in my experience was, even as a negotiator, that there were some cycles when we preferred to put more dollars into our health benefits than we did actually on the schedule. So, you know, there are a lot of variables here, and there's no answer. But this mandate has come to us from the school boards, and that is why I have constructed House File 511 to give more local control. And this is one area in which school boards have asked for relief, that the January 15th deadline be repealed and the penalty as well, so that they have the freedom to negotiate whether it's a lucrative time or a tough economic time. I think to return to local control without this penalty, that especially is harmful to our students, because in the end, if a district does not settle, it is really a penalty on our students. And so, Madam Chair, that's my answer to your question.
Thank you. That was good. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Alschwager, you commented about the percentage of teachers going down in a school budget. Is there a correlation between the increase in paras for special education because of the higher need in special education these days?
Representative Alschwager, or Ms. Alschwager.
Madam Chair and Representative McFarland, I don't have those figures. I don't know that we do have those figures. It might be something that the Department of Education could provide.
Madam Chair, so for
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for clarification, are there fewer teachers today than there were before? I mean, you're playing with percentages is kind of a funny game.
Ms. Alschwager?
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, I would certainly guess that there are fewer teachers than there were before, but not in every district. You know, some districts are growing, some are. Although, you know, I believe we have 14,000 more students coming into the system in this next year. So, you know, I really can't say.
Okay. Any more questions for Ms. Alschwager, Representative Scalzi?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I don't. It's not really a question, but you know, I just love percentages and I love charts. And when I see that, I knew that we were 16th. That's the figure I've been throwing around in teacher salaries. And now that we're 20th, I'm thinking, well, that takes into account a lot of states like Mississippi and Alabama. And when we look at those figures that we're 20th in teacher salaries, we also have to look at the corresponding figure that we're still first in the amount of in the ACT scores, and we're still, I think, first or second in the graduation rates, which gives us this huge gap. And I think we're still in the high second or fifth in the NAEP scores, which is the nation's report card. And I think, you know, we are doing something really right here. And if we've had something in effect for 20 years and we're still have these high scores that we should be really especially proud of, and yet our teachers are making 20th in the nation, I think we're doing something extra special. Our teachers, parents, and school district employees are really doing something really special. And I always think we always have to use those percentages in correlation when we're talking about changing the system because the school boards don't like it. I'm troubled by that.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, we can move on to the next witnesses. Okay, can Dan Campo and Chris Moe, Minnesota School Counselors Association? Hmm. welcome to the committee, and if you could please state your name and who you're representing for the tape.
Absolutely. My name is Dan Campbell. I'm representing the Minnesota School Counselors. Chris Moe is the president of the Minnesota School Counselors. He was unable to be here today. He had some issues he was dealing with at his school. So I'll be testifying just briefly on one point on the Safe Schools Levy portion of the bill.
Madam Chair, excuse me, but that's not in the purview of government operations. But if you want to hear the testimony, that's fine. But Section 6 is not in your purview.
Okay. Well, since we do have someone here, I think I'll allow it. But please keep in mind, members, that we are looking at Sections 1, 2, 3, 5, and 9. If you could just maybe feel free to state your point anyway.
Yeah, the only issue that I have that would that relates as far as this committee is, and forgive me because this is not an education committee, just a quick intro to give you an idea. Minnesota school counselors in schools are different than when we all went to school. The counselors that are working in schools now are people who, in addition to their regular education and training and degree, also have a master's or 2 years of mental health. And that mental health training is the piece that we're talking about and how it relates to the bill. Basically, for the last 20 years, counselor to student ratio has been next to last or dead last in Minnesota. Our surrounding states, for example, right now are at around 420-1 on average of students to counselors. Counselors in Minnesota were at 770-1. Now, I mentioned the master's program and the qualifications on mental health, things like that. These are the people who are at the front line in dealing with kids through via the testing, through the idea of what we traditionally know as the academic achievement, you know, getting kids into colleges or just anything as far as helping kids plan out their courses from grade school, junior high, even through high school. What that maintenance of effort piece does and where it relates to this committee is there's a maintenance of effort in the Safe Schools levy. That language has frozen the number of counselors within the educational system. As far as local government and how this works, there have been a lot of conversations about this being a local issue or a local choice on how to hire counselors. Well, it has been a local choice issue for the last 20 years, and we have been either next to last or dead last in the nation as far as those ratios. Due to the economy, things like that, we are seeing an increasing number of suicides and problems like that in schools. Where counselors have been trying to have a bigger effect is in trying to do suicide prevention, in screening those children, in assisting kids as they normally would in growing up to be young, productive adults and getting into college, but at the same time they're dealing with and screening those mental issues and then referring them to the appropriate people from there. Because of that, what I'm here today to basically speak to is, while it is the choice of the legislature to remove that maintenance of effort mandate, it has only been in effect for less than 6 months. And the issue that school counselors have is, when there was local control, we were last in the nation. Now there's not local control. It's a maintenance of effort mandate. It isn't perfect, but we're still dead last in the nation. And so the arguments to say that it needs to be eliminated, we feel, are coming too soon, and that we should give the program a little bit more of a choice. That's it.
Thank you. And again, the section that you're talking about is outside of the purview of our committee, but I see Representative Hornstein has a question, so I'll allow
that.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. And I totally recognize that, but you know, there's some issues that we as legislators feel personally, and this is one. We're having two daughters that recently graduated from high school and one still in high school. You know, we had a ratio of 1 to 900 or 1,000, and it was really difficult. And I guess I used to sit, Representative Erickson, on your committee in 2006 when Representative Mariani was chair. And I guess just very briefly, and I recognize that this is not in the in the bill, but what is happening in, to address this issue, you know, in your committee? And I think it's real, and I think it's significant and problematic. And, you know, I know I feel it, and many other parents feel it. And just your response to that very briefly.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Horsted. This bill is on the House floor, the maintenance of effort. That is Representative Depke's bill, and you probably noticed it on the calendar. We did not continue with the calendar for the day yesterday or last Thursday, but this bill will be coming. What we learned in education reform was that the set-aside has been the issue, and school boards have requested this as mandate relief. They have said they are not intending to reduce counselors. They are hoping to hire more counselors, but they do not want this this protected class, this set-aside that ties their hands. And so, again, this is intended as mandate relief. And I think all good school boards know how important counselors are, and they will find it in their budgets and in their curricular to provide for guidance for our students and, as Mr. Campo has so well said, you know, to take care of those other issues that affect our students day to day.
Thank you.
Okay, any more burning questions for the witness, even though it's not in our purview? Thank you, Mr. Campo. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on the bill? Okay. Do we have further questions for the author on the bill? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. Representative Erickson, or I think maybe to Ms. Dyson, under in Section 1, the interactive television technology for school board meetings. I wonder if you can answer this, Representative Erickson, or we have to talk or ask Ms. Dyson. But we already, I think 2 years ago, Representative Pulaski carried a bill that permitted electronic public meetings, and there were a set of standards and so forth that we developed to make that possible. And I wonder if your Section 1 follows those same requirements, is similar in nature, or is different. And I'm just wondering how it compares.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler. Yes, and perhaps we could have the School Boards Association step to the microphone and explain whether or not we need to do further amplification of this change.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're with for the tape.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Stein. I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And Representative Winkler, I think you are correct. I think that was specific to emergency situations. And so this is a general, and perhaps Council can correct me, but I think the purpose behind this, we're already allowed to do this with interactive TV. And so what we're looking at when she expands it to interactive television technology, I think we're looking at broader mediums that would include an audio and visual link, such as Skype. And so I don't imagine this is going to be used, nor has it been reported that it's been used a great deal, but it gives school boards an additional flexibility or additional tool for a board member who may be on a business trip in New York City and wants to take a vote on an issue, as long as there's an audio and visual link that the board and the board member who's in New York can participate. So that's the intent of this. So,
Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I wonder if Ms. Dyson can comment on
this. Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, the provision that you're recalling from 2009, I believe, is coded in the section before that, but it only applies to state agencies. It did not apply to local governments, and as the witness just said, the provision that applies to local governments for telephone and other electronic means was for the pandemic situation. So it was that also had a limitation. Under current law, school districts can conduct meetings by interactive TV. What they've added is the word technology. So presumably that expands it beyond just a television.
And, Madam Chair,
Representative Winkler.
Ms. Dyson, I guess the only question is whether the language for school boards mirrors the language for state agencies, or if it's different because there's some substantive reason why.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, the provision in the bill is being added to the section that permits meetings to be conducted by interactive TV, and that has this basically the same provisions where everybody participating can hear or see one another, that members of the public present at the regular meeting site can hear and see all discussion and testimony and all the votes of the members of the body, that at least one member of the body is physically present at the regular meeting site. So, yes, it does say that all of those conditions still apply.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions to the bill? Representative Hornstein.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair. I really appreciated Ms. Allswager's testimony on Section 2, and it reminded me of the bill we had in here a couple of weeks ago, Representative Westrom's bill on rulemaking, and I think we're just on a slippery slope when rulemaking then becomes the purview of the legislature, and there's just a lot of technical issues and expertise that's required in the rulemaking process, and so it seems like we now have several bills where we are delegating executive branch authority to the legislature, and again, while I haven't agreed with Representative and then former Governor Pawlenty on a number of issues, he vetoed that the Westrom bill in the past, I think, simply based on the separation of powers. So I think we know this. I noticed this again, and it seems like it may come up in other bills, and I'll oppose this bill for a variety of reasons, but I think we ought to really be careful about delegating rulemaking authority on any issue to the legislature. So just an observation, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hornstein. I understand your concerns. The first clause in this long sentence is a clarification that the commissioner does have the ability to revise and align, to make rules, to create rules consistent with the review cycle. What is happening in regard to the second half of the clause is that as revisions of the academic standards are done, and we have now completed language arts, math, I believe you heard testimony to last year, and now we're in social studies, is that we have such a changing curricula across the nation. We have a drive for national standards, which, of course, could lead to national tests, which could lead to national curriculum. And I think it is important for legislative leaders, such as we are, to know whether or not that's been embedded in the standards. The language arts standards we now have are national standards, adopted, much to my dismay, by our former commissioner, who shares the same political views I do, but nevertheless felt the national standards were better. I would have argued that it's better for us to, as a state, create standards rather than turning ourselves over to a national standard, which I think does proceed to become a national test and national curricula. I don't think Minnesota wants that. Now, last year, I think you had the debate over Common Core standards, national standards for math versus Minnesota-based standards. The Minnesota standards were adopted, and the rulemaking was done, and now they're in effect. So I think it's important that we hear those debates. Many of us around this table do not appreciate No Child Left Behind, which is a federal mandate. Yes, it wouldn't be there if we didn't accept the money. But I think we need to be thinking very strategically, and not politically, but strategically for our students, about the impact that national standards can have on our state when we take such great pride, as Representative Scalzi has pointed out, that we do well in many areas. And Representative Scalzi, just to comment on your comment about how well we do, you know, it's because teachers work so hard. And I'll tell you how hard I worked in the classroom and had students who excelled at every level they were capable of. But we work very hard, and we put salary, I think, secondary in many instances. And maybe we shouldn't, but we do because we are so committed to what our calling is, and that's to make sure that every student in our classroom achieves. And I would hope that we would have that same concern about what the standards and benchmarks are in our state.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just want to ask a question back to Representative Erickson about what she was just talking about. I think we, on a range of issues, whether it's education, curriculum, environmental protection, the range of difference between federal standards and state standards is something that's always important to us, and Minnesota often wants to do much better than the national. But I'm not sure that this amended version of House File 511 really gets us there. What I'm concerned about is by requiring a legislative directive in order to adopt new standards is that you're putting politics into the process instead of taking it out, and that you're making it very hard and slow to make changes, because getting to a point of agreement between political parties and the legislature and the governor to authorize changes, it seems to me, can sometimes take years, and we might bog down on issues like evolution or how social studies curricula are established, or what the specific requirements are. Politicization of education curriculum, it seems to me, is very dangerous. And if we don't like something that the commissioner has done through rule, the legislature, of course, could take action to rescind it, and that could take a day if it was not good for the state of Minnesota. But it seems to me our presumption should be to let the agency establish the rules, and the legislature should set broad guidelines, and then we should react if they overreach. But by putting us into the process, it seems to me you're making it political, and you're potentially slowing down important changes. And I guess I wonder, why wouldn't we just allow the current system to exist where we can react if they go too far?
Representative Erickson?
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, I think that's exactly what we're doing. Now, I've been stating my personal perspective on this. The school boards have brought this to us because they're concerned about the purchase of new materials that will come very quickly, and you probably aren't aware, but some of the dates have been changed in other places in this section to accommodate the school board's concern about a new purchase of curricula. Because remember, we don't determine curriculum or curricula as legislators. We determine whether or not the standards and the benchmarks set for the standards are those standards which will help our students achieve at the highest level possible, at whatever learning level they are. So that's our purview, and I think that's been in place for all my teaching career. Was that whether it was outcome-based education or it was a profile of learning, and I don't want to say it was politicized, maybe it was, but the legislature weighed in at every turn, and through my entire career, no, not my entire career, because I started teaching in the 60s, in 1963, when we were for the most part left alone. But beginning in the 70s, there was really a trend in this country to move toward legislative, at times I called it interference, but legislative purview over the attempts to, to close the achievement gap or to increase achievement or to in some way, make Minnesota better. And I think that was always the intent of the legislature, was to move us to a higher position in ranking across the nation. We teachers accepted some of it, and a lot of it we just said, that too shall pass, and we moved on with the solid teaching that we were doing in our classrooms in regard to the materials we used, which is the curriculum. For the most part, we always had, at least in the English department where I taught, the very best standards we could develop, and they were very much aligned with advanced placement standards, which are very very high standards. So I think that what we're doing here is important in light of the federal government, from my perspective, not from school boards, but from my perspective, a federal government wanting to have more control over us than I would hope that we would want.
Representative Winkler?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I guess I don't understand the A5 amendment, but it's, as I read the language, it suggests that the commissioner can revise and align standards, so they can basically update things. Mm-hmm. But if they want to undertake any kind of
implementation.
Pardon?
Representative Erickson?
They want to go ahead and implement them, yes. Then we want legislative approval before that step.
And Madam
Representative Winkler.
Yes, Madam Chair, and that's it seems to me that is different. And you testified that you thought that state interference with teaching and learning was often unhelpful, and it seems to me that putting the legislature in the mix before that can happen isn't going to make the interference less. It's going to make it just a much more political process to get to these changes. And there's certainly no, there's nothing in here that says how often or that should happen. So I guess I understand what your testimony is, but that doesn't seem to align with what this bill does as amended, and which seems to me just puts the legislature in the business of being a state board of education, which I think is a little dangerous.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having been involved in curriculum committees and the school board, and having the privilege of being on a academic standards committee and having that committee elect me to chair the writing committee, I understand some of this process and the review of different state standards to come up with the best mix. It's like buying, you look around, I like this from this house and that, etc., to get what is the best. And I do understand that too often the education community has this flavor of the year, whether it's outcome-based or whatever fad. And I think the legislative oversight and review is key to add an outside perspective, a global perspective. And I do believe Minnesota has better standards because we do not just take what the nation takes as an average. We set goals based on us. So I would support this idea, and it allows for that global oversight and review.
Representative Erickson, I'm just curious that you might have mentioned this, maybe I missed it. Do we know how much the mandate reduction might save the school districts? I'm kind of trying to figure out if that can possibly be used to offset any potential reductions that might happen.
Madam Chair, I don't have a specific figure. I just have, maybe a couple, $2 to $5 million maybe, or more. Don't know, and they would have to verify that. And for clarification purposes, the amendment that we adopted was my amendment. Other amendments that were added in education reform were from the School Boards Association. So the specific wording of this almost mirrors Representative Greiling's amendment from last year, as I understand it, that she wasn't able to get adopted because I believe there was no omnibus bill, if I remember correctly. But this was her amendment that I simply mirrored here.
Okay. Any further discussion to the bill? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I think there is a fiscal impact, but this is not a fiscal committee, but it is. There's definitely a fiscal impact.
Yeah.
And I'm sure this goes to K-12.
Right.
To education finance.
Okay. Hearing no further discussion, Representative Sanders renews his motion that House File 511 pass as amended and be re-referred to Education Finance. Any other discussion? All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
No. Motion does prevail, and the bill will be moved to Education Finance. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Runbeck here. She's a hard one to get a hold of. Next, we'll be taking up Representative Runbeck's bill, House File 696. And just housekeeping, we do not have committee tomorrow. We'll next meet on Thursday. Would you like to meet tomorrow, Representative Winkler?
No, I remember hearing about all these stacks of bills we had.
We do.
Madam Chair, Representative Pulaski would have adjourned the meeting if the author wasn't.
I heard that. Yes, I did hear that. See, I'm the kinder, gentler Representative Pulaski. That
you're your own.
Yes, I'm sure I almost fell out of the window, huh?
Yes, you did. Representative Rumbeck, where does your bill need to travel?
Madam Chair, I because this does have some impact on school districts, I suspect it would need to go to K-12 finance.
Okay. Can I have a motion for Representative Rundbeck? All right, I will move. Seeing none, I will move that House File 696 be recommended to pass and be referred to Education Finance. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have the House File 696, and it has to do with bonding for sort of soft issues, which I consider to be retiree health benefits, sort of fringe benefits, as well as unfunded pension liabilities. And, you know, it's been a really standard and well and long accepted practice and occurrence in state and local government that we bond for capital assets. That makes a whole lot of sense because a road or a bridge or a public facility that's in use for the next 30 to 50 years is something that you would expect future taxpayers to pay for. And so capital bonding, to me, is a well-respected and long-accepted use, and who can deny that that's the right thing to do? But we've got some issues for local government where we have given bonding authority to bond for unfunded pension liability as well as liabilities with respect to retiree health benefits and other fringe benefits. And one particular authority was granted in 2008. Apparently it was in a public finance bill that was described as being quite technical, nothing major in this bill, members. Well, it turns out that in the bill was an expanded authority to bond for retiree health benefits. And to me, it's not really, really wrong. First of all, these are benefits that most folks in the private sector don't have access to, and these are benefits then that local governments aren't paying for. They're not paying for as they go. Obviously, if you have to bond for it, you don't have the funds. You have made promises and commitments that you can't afford, and therefore you're bonding and hoping that you're going to be able to find in the marketplace some growth in your resources. And so the bill would really close the door to that avenue, and I think in closing the door to that avenue, we're saying local governments, you have to live within your means, you have to pay as you go, you have to find other more transparent avenues to take care of these costs, and probably for the future you have to actually not offer these benefits to any of your folks. So the bill would repeal the exemption from net debt. So this is a new term to me, but I gather that net debt, I've learned that net debt is a way we restrain local governments from exceeding certain limits of bonded indebtedness. And so what happened in 2008 was that we said that net debt did not include such things as retiree health benefits and unfunded pension liabilities. So the bill would repeal that exemption. It would repeal the authority altogether. And then it would, the following year, I guess 2009, there was an additional requirement that school districts that used this authority would have to go to a referendum before they allowed, before this happened. Well, it turns out that school districts have not used that authority. They don't want to go to referendum for this kind of thing, and so there really hasn't been any additional use of it. But the bill would repeal the authority to issue debt without a referendum. But, you know, the truth is that the water's over the dam. If you look at the spreadsheet that I handed out, almost one half of school districts have taken advantage of this authority, and there's a lot of their liabilities they are now bonding for. So I think it's pretty evident that what we've had is a situation where commitments were made that are just not affordable. And as school districts, and certainly as money has become tight and so on, it's apparent that this is even more unaffordable. So what I'm encouraging members to do is to consider this bill. We do need to strain our local elected officials. I know that a lot of folks in my caucus think that local control is something you just have and you just do the right thing. But obviously, our elected officials are under a lot of pressure not to do the responsible, accountable, transparent thing when it comes to spending other people's money. And so I encourage you to support this bill that would repeal the authority.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm hearing a lot of what you said there. You're talking about school districts and school districts doing this. And if that's what this is at, I guess I would like to do an oral amendment, because this doesn't just hit school districts. It also hits cities and municipalities and counties. And it's my understanding there hasn't been a lot of counties and cities that have been using this debt. They've been very judicious about how they use it. So I'd like to amend this set to reinsert the stricken language on line 3.19 and 3.20, and take the city's part of it out of it. Because, like I said, if you're talking about school districts and you've got into the whole issue of local control, I mean, we keep hearing local control is the mantra. We heard it in the previous bill of returning to local control. This whole bill seems to be taking local control away and saying that we as the legislature are the big brother, the dad, that we're going to tell you how to do this because we know more than you. And like I said, but that's kind of comments on the overall, what I see is the overall tenure of this bill. But if it's just that we're concerned about school districts, I think by taking out 3.19 and 3.20, we'll be removing cities from that have been pretty good about not using these debts.
Representative Nelson, I think Ms. Dyson has a comment. This might take a minute to do what you want to do here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, the provision on 3.19 to 3.20 is the exclusion from the referendum requirement that applies to issuing local debt. But your oral amendment doesn't reinstate language in Section 2, which is where the authority to issue the debt for actuarial liabilities is. And I guess I would need a little time to sort through how to do it just for municipalities and exclude school districts from that. But you would need to reinstate more the language in Section 2 as well. So I'd need a little time to work on that to figure out how to do it.
Representative Nelson, would you like to work with Ms. Dyson, and I can take questions to the bill while you're working on it?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay, so for temporarily, we will take the motion off the table since it needs to be fixed. Perhaps you could comment on it while we're...
Right. If I could just comment, I would not accept that amendment. Members, I think having the authority in statute is a is a green light means that we think this is an acceptable practice. And I realize that it is just a few municipalities that have used the authority, but that doesn't mean that we should say it should still be available. There need to be other and better ways and more taxpayer-friendly ways to deal with the kind of, issues that we're looking at here. So I do not support the amendment, however you might draft it.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to see clarification. I thought that Representative Nelson's was to expand to not only include school districts but counties and municipalities. So it would be an expansion thereof and not giving them the authority back. Am I correct on that, Representative Nelson?
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my understanding, and I'm just going to go double check on this and work with Ms. Dyson, but this would be give back. This is a municipality. It's not that doesn't apply to school districts, just municipalities, my understanding. But I
Madam Chair.
Representative McFarland.
It seems to me that the school OPED bill was done more recently, and I think the municipality part was done back in the 80s. Is that correct?
Yes. Take another question. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I'm going to go in just a little different direction to the bill while they work out their what they think they want to do with the amendment. But I'm thinking back, Representative Runbeck, to a mess we cleaned up a couple years ago with the Minneapolis Teacher Fund, which had actually been a closed account, and with a declining obligation going forward over the next period of years. And because the fund was facing insolvency, and the recipients of the payments from that fund were not eligible for Social Security. It's the only thing they depended on. An understanding was worked out, an agreement that was passed bipartisanly here, as I recall, that absorbed the obligations of that fund into the teacher retirement account here. Not to dissect that whole thing, but just to think about the declining obligation of a certain group of retirees that had a benefit. And I'm thinking about then bonding. If a city or a government entity has recognized that past practice has not been prudent, perhaps it's not sustainable. I can think of a couple of examples that are out there floating around now that we're going to have to clean up here in the next few years. But if past indiscretions have been cleaned up and going forward they're on sound footing, wouldn't that be an opportunity where bonding actually might make sense in a limited case like that, to bond for low-cost money for an obligation or a liability that was actually declining and had a certain date where it would end? Do you follow my question here?
Representative Runbeck.
Madam Chair and Representative, I mean, you may be right about that. I think, though, then the obligation is let's have the referendum happen in those municipalities where this is occurring. Let's let the voters know, and if they're not happy with it, then we'll find some other ways to do it. This is a very intransparent, non-transparent, non-accountable way for. For this issue to be handled, and I think that frankly it's own up to what you've done, because I think most taxpayers don't know, I think most state reps didn't know, frankly, what we were looking at.
Madam Chair, if I could follow
Representative
up,
Representative Beard,
perhaps I'm misreading the legislation you're proposing, then, Representative Runbeck. Because obviously using the company credit card to pay for an expanding liability that should be accounted for in current funds doesn't make any sense at all, and I think we're probably all with you on that. Am I understanding your legislation then is just to say that if a municipality or government wants to bond for these pension-type costs going forward, that it can do so through a referendum of the voters in their jurisdiction? Is that what I'm missing here? Or is it a blanket prohibition that they cannot do it ever?
Representative Beard, it is a blanket prohibition because these are current liabilities, if I understand it, in most cases. And in fact, in the retiree health benefit area, I am not aware that there's even been funds set aside to pay for these. So unlike the pension liability issue, where they are putting away money. In the retiree benefit area, I don't think you see that, and so they really are immediate liabilities. So it's
well, Madam Chair,
Senator Beard.
I'm not sure. Maybe I didn't convey the question accurately enough. There seemed to be. Does your bill create a blanket prohibition against anybody doing this, even if they take it to a referendum of the voters?
Oh. Representative Beard, no, I think that once the authority has been repealed, and if there are still issues, first of all, this is not, if there have been unfunded liabilities that are now being bonded for, we're not going back and, undoing that, trying to rewind that. It's for current and future liabilities. And that's what it would address by repealing the authority and saying that the districts then have to go to seek the referendum.
Okay. Let me ponder that for a moment, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Actually, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Runbeck, I see the hand out here from Bloomberg Businessweek about how perhaps the trend in the future is that some units of government, at least according to the Michigan folks, will get out of the business altogether of providing retiree health benefits. Is that a trend that you seek to encourage? In other words, do you see the provision of retiree health benefits as maybe not prudent or no longer prudent if it once was? Or is this just sort of passing interest? In other words, is it your view that generally speaking, government should get out of the business of providing health benefits for retirees?
Representative Runbeck.
Chair and Representative Simon. Yeah, it's the latter. I think that, you know, when you see the size of this this OPEB debt, okay, when you see the size of it, then it really tells you that it's out of control, that it isn't going to fit within sort of the current revenue picture and the current cost structures, that you've got budgetary issues that are really problematic. It probably says you've also got a lot of unfunded maintenance or deferred maintenance. I mean, some of these issues are what gets pushed to the side, you know, in our current sort of budgeting situation. So, yeah, I would say this is not something we can go forward with, and you know, the hope with this bill is that we'll have more districts that actually end those benefits.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate your point of view. I think, you know, as we're all experiencing this session, and in past sessions for that matter, it's always that push-pull. We want government to be as effective as possible. We want it to be as efficient as possible. We want to attract the best and the brightest, if we can, in all levels of government, but sometimes that means offering benefits that aren't available or aren't as prevalent in the private sector. I mean, the private sector has other tools. They have stock options. They have profit sharing. Obviously, we don't have that in government, so there are other things that government can do. I'm imagining for those that choose to do it, whether it's a county or a city, this is one of those benefits. I think, you know, it is a push-pull. I mean, reasonable people can disagree, but this seems to me like one tool that units of government have to recruit and retain good people. Otherwise, it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You don't get the best and the brightest. You don't get people who stay. And I just worry about taking away a tool from cities and counties that they may deem worthy in order to retain and to attract the best people. You know, I don't know. I've never been involved in labor negotiations. I would imagine that's one of the reasons they do it. Controlling costs is another matter, and you're right. There may be some in Minnesota and elsewhere who are just plain irresponsible. That may be, and we've read some of the headlines. But I think it's important to realize that there's a balance there. I do worry, though, about taking a tool away completely from units of government, especially those who may be using it responsibly. And I think there is accountability ultimately, as all of us know, because city leaders and county leaders are on the ballot as well, just as we are. And if voters are fed up with their property tax statement, if they're fed up with the way finances are being managed, they know who to take it out on. And there are some members here today and members in the audience I know who are from local governments, and they know that they're accountable as well. So that would be my concern. You know, we can't denigrate government for screwing up or doing things badly and then rob them of the tools to get the people who would do it differently or better.
Madam Chair, and just a response to that, I mean, I think that tools are important, but they need to be sort of out there so people can really understand. I think no one knew about this. You know, we didn't make it sort of public, and, you know, that voters were going to get big hits on their property taxes wasn't known until it happened. And so, fine, if they think they can afford these benefits in the future and they can make a way to pay for them, no problem. But I don't think hiding it and sort of putting it out to the future and not paying for it as they go is the right way. I'll just draw your attention, too, to the one handout showing this is a Maplewood property, It's a business. And you can note that in this, under other local levies in the school district area, those levies, and I've seen several other statements very similar, where the other local levies, those that are non-voter approved, are now much bigger than the voter approved levies when it comes to school districts. And so, yeah, I think voters are becoming very concerned. But it's time to sort of put the cork in it and slam the door on using this as a tool for the future. Better ways are available. I'm confident.
Senator Scalzi?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And you know, I agree with what you're saying about. I mean, this is really. I look at these property tax statements and I think, what does that mean? And most of us, we just let it go over our head and we don't look into what we should be looking into. But to Representative Beard's comments, my fear would be that there might be some cities or school districts or counties that do give too much, or maybe their pension obligations are too high. But when I look at what we did in it last year, cleaning up some of this pension obligation, it comes down to every taxpayer in the state. So that's my fear, and I think that's what Representative Beard was getting at. Whereas if a city or a county, like you say in this example, it does something that we might not agree with, then my feeling is that they should be responsible for that rather than every taxpayer in the state. So if there's unfunded pension liabilities and we take away their right to bond for those, then who would pay for that? Then would it come down to you and me and everybody in the state if school district X had unfunded pension liabilities? That, I guess, is my broader question.
Sure.
Representative Scalzi.
Yeah, well,
run back.
Representative Scalzi, you know, I certainly don't want it to become a state problem. Don't want to see bailouts at the state level. You know, and frankly, where they have to occur is probably the local level, perhaps within the current membership of the employee base even, and certainly the referendum process, you know, is the way that it would need to go.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. But if the referendum fails, then it becomes a state bailout. I guess that's my concern, and I think that's what he's gone now. But and I don't want to put words in his mouth. That is what I heard when I heard him talk about that. But that's my concern.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, I mean, it would be of interest to me to see maybe the district work out, you know, a 10-year plan for resolving the issue. Do you think that the current employee base should bear some of the cost too? I mean, so it needs to be, I think, sort of a negotiated and big discussion with the taxpayers, because it's so obvious that this is really very out of hand.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I wonder if Ms. Dyson could give us a clarification. I want to be sure I understand the answer to Representative Beard's question about whether this tool could ever be used or if it could only be used with a referendum, or so what this bill does.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, the bill repeals the authority to issue debt for the unfunded pension liabilities and for other post-employment benefit liabilities. It doesn't leave in an option for a referendum. Under current law, cities, counties, and towns are exempt from the referendum requirement for issuing this kind of debt. School districts, as of 2009, have to have a referendum in order to issue debt for this purpose. But the bill repeals all of the authority, so they would not be able to issue debt if this bill is enacted.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Runbeck, you know, we do have built-in mechanisms for evaluating the debt load and the level of fiscal responsibility for government entities issuing debt. Bond ratings, of course, are a part of that. That's the private sector evaluating the debt capacity and the trustworthiness of the debt of those local government units. We also have oversight at the state level. And I guess I wonder, I know this is something you don't like, but my question is this tool something that has raised flags with bond houses or with the Department of Education or with Minnesota Management and Budget or the legislative auditor or anybody or the state auditor? Has this risen as an issue through any of the normal channels we have for evaluating the responsibility of local government units?
Representative Rundeck.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, you know, especially the area of retiree health benefits is a very interesting one. We don't regulate that at the state level in the same way that we regulate pension benefits. So there, frankly, isn't any, you know, central sort of watchdog. We don't get annual assessments and evaluations and reports on that area. So I think it's a particular problem. It's one we, you know, no one is addressing. So I think it's, you know, it really bears a lot more attention.
Oh. Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Rundbeck, it seems to me the first place to start then would be to gather some information about retiree health benefits, because I heard you say that we have this oversight for pensions. So first I'd say that this bill, by taking this tool away on pensions, is unnecessary, because we actually have a pretty solid system of overviewing pension liabilities in the state. But if we have nothing for retiree health benefits, why shouldn't we start with a legislative auditor doing that? And, you know, as a member of the majority party, generally that would be a pretty easy thing to get reviewed. Or, you know, I don't know. I assume that there are any other number of ways that we could actually get some information about retiree health benefits before we just take unilateral action to remove this tool without having any actual information about whether it's being used well or misused, or whether it's important for some reasons or not important for other reasons. I just feel like this is rushing forward based on a belief rather than taking careful action based on information, which is, I think, what pension and health benefit bills require. And you may have a comment on that, and then I'll give you one more just to respond to, and that is whether you're going to get a vote from the Pension Commission on this legislation and get their blessing before moving forward and trying to pass this bill.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, yeah, I've had those same thoughts, and I frankly would be, you know, if we can work up an amendment on the way, say, to K-12 finance, that would actually begin to require of the state auditor to collect the information and to gather it and analyze it, I think that would be really the long-term way to go. So I'm very in favor of that, and would really enjoy the opportunity to work on that, because I think that's probably, for everyone's satisfaction, you know, really where we need to start to.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Winkler,
this is the committee that would do that, and I don't think this bill should move forward to another committee until we actually address the concerns that may be legitimate. We don't know, but they may be legitimate concerns about retiree health benefits, but we shouldn't begin to move this through the process until the Government Operations Committee has had a chance to digest it. So I won't make a motion to table the bill, but I would urge us to hold it over until we have time to work through some of these issues.
Madam Chair,
Representative Rundbeck.
I'm sorry, did you say to lay it over?
He said to lay it over, not to table, just lay it over.
Okay, very good. I mean, I'm happy to do that and fix it up.
Representative Nelson, did you want to hold off on your amendment then, since if we're going to lay this over, or would you like to? How would you like to handle that?
Why don't we hold off on the amendment if we're going to lay it over, and we can work, give us time to work on it to make sure we're not rushing and getting something? But we'll get the amendment drafted then, and so we can do it.
Okay, then. I think that in light of some... Oh, I'm sorry, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is kind of germane to the laying over of this bill. I wonder, again, I'm drawing on my municipal experience, a few years ago, maybe four or five, cities, counties, school districts were forced to account under Gadsby, I think it was 34, all of their unfunded liabilities, and this may be pushing this issue to the forefront. as they went back and tried to comply with that, found out that they weren't properly funded in the past, and now on a go-forward basis, they would work that into their general fund operations and those kinds of things. So I guess I would want us to kind of quantify to see if any of that is at play here, because the issue may be resolving itself as, well, the old adage, as the mouse is working its way through the snake.
Yeah.
Madam Chair and
Representative Runbeck,
is there, I mean, without having the information available, though, can we discover that?
Representative Driscoll?
I do believe that that is something that we can visit with either appropriate state agencies, or actually start just doing some polling with some of the districts that we see on here and say, why has this come about? Has it come about as a result of Gadsby 34, and see where we're at? I think that we would get an idea if we're heading in the right direction or if it's completely and totally something different. But I think that a couple calls, because I know I will be calling my districts and asking that question based on the information you brought to light today.
Okay. I will lay this over, but I will have Mr. Rice has been wanting to testify, so before I do that, I will have Mr. Rice
testify.
Madam Chair,
just quickly, Brian Rice, Minneapolis Police and Fire Relief Associations. I think that Representative, is it O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Raised a very important point. I think that he is accurate that this issue of retiree health benefits has been addressed by GASBs and other entities. And what I'd like the committee to focus on is two distinct pieces of legislation. In 1986, the legislature authorized cities to bond for unfunded pension obligations. That was a bill that I worked on 25 years ago. That provision stayed dormant for at least 15 years, and then, to my knowledge, the only city in the state that's used it is the city of Minneapolis, and they used it for my two clients. The boards agreed with the city on that, and we believe they were prudent and wise in the exercise of that use of pension bonding. And I think there's an important distinction the committee should make, and in all due respect to Representative Runbeck, I think she is on to an important issue to look at. But the pension benefit levels are set by the legislature, and it's monitored, overseen by the Pension Commission, by the state auditor, by a number of reports. And the legislature tightly controls those issues. In 2008, this issue of retiree health insurance coverage came up, and those are really decisions that were made locally by school districts in the collective bargaining process. And it led to some rather significant liabilities and potentially some significant problems, so much to the point that the state auditor's office, I believe, stepped in and required some additional reporting. It became a bigger thing, and GASB actually stepped in and looked at that issue. So I would submit there's really two different constructs that Representative Runbeck's bill is looking at. One is the pension issue, one is the retiree health benefit. It so happened that in 2008, I think the school districts or maybe others looked at this earlier bill in 86 that allowed bonding for pension obligations, and it seemed similar, and they kind of piggybacked on that provision, and that goes to Ms. Dyson's point about they're intertwined, at least in one section of the statute. And disentangling them might, in Representative Nelson's bill or amendment, take some effort. But I would submit that they're two separate issues, and they ought to be treated separately. I think the city of Minneapolis is here, and they would have more testimony on the efficacy and how they used it and if they plan to use it. I think a pretty strong argument could be made that on the pension issue, that it's probably an appropriate tool to have in the toolbox for cities to deal with it in certain cases, to do so appropriately. And perhaps on the school issue, it may require a lot more scrutiny. I think Representative Runbeck, because these school districts and collective bargaining agreements had the authority to do it, it may have created a lot bigger problems and for many more jurisdictions than are otherwise done on the pension front. And I just a quick closing note. We've heard a lot about pensions. We know you're all dealing with a lot of taxpayers' issues, bonding stuff. But Minnesota is really, really unique on the pension issue. It's been the policy of this state to have the state control pensions. In fact, our Public Employment Labor Relations Act specifically excludes pensions from collective bargaining. You can't bargain pensions at the table. You can't bargain contribution rates at the table. It's really solely in the domain of the legislature to decide those issues. And quite frankly, that's proving to be a really prescient policy. Wisconsin's PELRA Act, which was enacted 12 years earlier than Minnesota's, allowed collective bargaining of contributions, and that led to, you know, some quite would say, frankly, an imbalance in terms of what employees contribute relative to their employers. And when you give employers that jurisdiction, although there's a lot of great school district boards, you're opening the floodgates to a lot of individual boards. Representative Driscoll, I haven't had the opportunity to meet you, but I'm sure that you did a great job in your school district. But there's a lot of school districts, the level of knowledge may not be as great, and some districts might have, you know, entered into arrangements that are probably less than wise. And so I think you're really differing, you know, dealing with two different, you know, things when it comes to pensions and to this thing. And I would say, just the last point, I know that a lot, I wasn't involved in it, but I know there was a lot of effort with the auditor's office and others on this whole retiree health and insurance issue, which came up in school districts. So I just wanted to offer that for the committee's edification, and we would be glad to work with you, Representative Runbeck, to see if there's a solution that could be, you know, acceptable to the committee to address this problem.
Very good.
Okay, very good. Thanks for your testimony. I think we've had some great discussion, and since it looks like we do need to find some more information to be able to move forward with the bill, this time I will lay the bill over, and Representative Runbeck, you can continue to work on it. And with that, I will adjourn the meeting. See you on Thursday.